Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting. And also by the Honda Fit. The all-new Honda Fit is small on the outside, yet roomy and versatile on the inside. Check it out at fit.honda.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Sam Halgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Coming up on tonight's show, Robert Altman brings Garrison Keillor's Powder Milk Biscuits to the big screen, plus reviews of Russian blockbuster Night Watch and The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada, both out now on DVD.
Also on the show, Massacre Theater, listener feedback, music by The Bottle Rockets, and our countdown of the top five movies of the year so far. But first, Nunchucks, Chapstick, Vote for Pedro, Napoleon Dynamite is a certified cult phenomenon. Now, director Jared Hess is back with Nacho Libre.
Today, I saw a man in town. People were throwing daisies at him and giving him goodies. He was a luchador. Sometimes I would like that kind of respect.
Wrestling is a sin. If you fight for someone who needs your help, only then will God bless you in battle.
Psst! Chancho! I need to borrow some sweats!
Say what you will about filmmaker Jared Hess, whether his movies are good or bad, or more importantly, funny or unfunny. With Napoleon Dynamite and now Nacho Libre, I think it would be unfair to argue that he is an incompetent filmmaker. There is a calculated quality to Hess's absurd brand of humor, from his static compositions to his handling of actors, that calls to mind the work of Wes Anderson. Yet Anderson, the director of Bottle Rocket, Rushmore, and The Royal Tenenbaums, is widely adored by film buffs and critics, while Hess is widely adored by 14-year-olds. Sam, you're a huge fan of Bottle Rocket, but not by any means an Anderson disciple. Does Nacho Libre, which stars Jack Black as a Mexican monastery cook turned lucha libre wrestler, succeed in elevating Hess to Anderson's level?
Well, not quite, I think, is the short answer here. And you can't help but think of Wes Anderson when you see his films. I think particularly Nacho Libre, actually. And they both have this kind of DIY aesthetic sensibility. They create these sort of intricate physical worlds that extend to the sort of realities they create in the films themselves, the tone of them. And I think that Hess has a real great creative streak. He's very creative, particularly the opening scene of Nacho Libre, which sort of parallels the sort of wonderful opening scene, I think, of Napoleon Dynamite, his first film, which is, the credit sequence over the White Stripes song, We're Gonna Be Friends, with a credit sequence, played out with like school lunch food. And I thought it was really fun. It really set a nice tone for that film. And with Nacho Libre, we have this, young Nacho stealing material to build his first luchador costume. And it's really funny and creative, and it's totally charming. And unfortunately, I think it's the best scene in the movie, honestly. Unlike Wes Anderson, whose movies are equally absurd and emotionally resonant, I think Hess's two films just sort of stick with absurdity. And really, they don't add up to much more than a kind of Saturday morning cartoon kind of sensibility or depth, really. And that's totally fine. I mean, certainly certain scenes work on a very comic level, especially when you've got somebody like Jack Black, who through sheer force of will can make something work and make something funny. Over the course of an hour and a half, it gets frustrating, really, that that his characters, the relationships, really don't add up to much more than that.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, and I have to say that unfortunately the funniest part of this movie for me was watching the second Talladega Nights trailer before the movie started. Did you see it, Sam?
Unfortunately not. I may have
arrived. They have a brand new Talladega Nights trailer.
I can't wait.
That is somehow even funnier than the first one. It really is. It totally takes a different spin on the movie.
My top five most anticipated movie of 2006.
That's right, and we'll get into that a little bit later, but it was hilarious. That was the funniest part of my night, unfortunately. And it really did feel like a Wes Anderson movie for me. That's why I brought it up there in the setup, watching this movie much more so than the first one. I think you agree. Napoleon Dynamite felt more unique than this one does, where it really does feel like he's kind of on the same comedic ground. But unfortunately, this felt for me just like watching Wes Anderson's The Life Aquatic. Yeah. I like The Royal Tenenbaums and Rushmore and Bottle Rocket. And then with The Life Aquatic, it almost felt like Wes Anderson was parodying himself, really talented actors that aren't really doing anything funny, but were expected to laugh because they're really talented actors acting very serious in very stupid scenarios, and it's a Wes Anderson movie, so it's right. funny, and you should just get it. It's almost elitist. It's like, you're either going to think this is funny, or
and if you
you're
don't
not
get
smart
it, there's
enough.
Something wrong with you. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of the feeling I had watching The Life Aquatic, and unfortunately, that's kind of how I felt here, and I have to say that the theater was more or less packed, and it was high school night, apparently, at the theater, because a lot of young people there, sure. and they were hanging on every Jack Black word and movement. Though I have to say, it almost felt to me like they were doing it almost because they felt like they were supposed to. Right. They were laughing.
They'd
at
be quizzed on Monday morning.
Exactly.
Like, did you like the scene where?
Yeah,
you know,
that's yeah, exactly right. Like in the hallways at school, right. they'd have to quote these lines. They
They're
were
already
laughing
printing
at
up
things.
The T-shirts. The Vote for Pedro T-shirts are being replaced by the
exactly.
Luchador costume.
But there's yeah. nothing really as funny in this movie that's even as funny, I think, as Napoleon Dynamite. And I've said before that I'm not a huge fan of that movie. I didn't really get Napoleon Dynamite, but I can see why people love it so much. Yeah. There are some scenes in it that are hilarious. The brother character, I think, the relative character who's the guy who wants to build the time machine
yeah, the
because
brother, right.
he thinks he can go back and be a high school star and he could right. have been a pro. I mean, that's gold.
Yeah.
There's nothing that funny in Nacho Libre, unfortunately. And with that said, I do want to point out that I think that on a filmmaking level, I do think this is a better made film than even something like Wedding Crashers. It's not nearly as funny, but I do think it's more competently directed from the compositions, the way he uses the camera, and the consistency of the humor and the way the actors are directed. You've got a case where you can tell these actors are very much acting within a Jared Hess style.
Absolutely.
Jack Black is not being Jack Black, except in a
few
moments.
There are moments.
There are moments,
where
but
the Jack
for
the
Black
most part, through, yeah.
you can tell, just like with the Wes Anderson movie, that he has very much coordinated exactly how he wants everything yep. to look and everybody in it to act.
Well, it's very deadpan, and it's funny. I mean, we've been, you know, on the podcast, we're doing this Werner Herzog marathon, and Herzog gets a lot of play out of just the local color, you know, just capturing the faces of the native people in some way. And Jared Hess, you know, gets quite a bit of ground out of that, too, just the faces of young, overweight or impoverished children in the orphanage, or really the fans at the Mexican wrestling contest. Mm-hmm. I mean, he does that. I mean, it's very much this deadpan thing, and I don't think he's condescending to the culture at all. I think he does a fairly good job in terms of, like you said, creating a very distinct deadpan sensibility that creates a world that is unique in some way. But unfortunately, I think he disrupts that reality frequently by, and I can't say if this is the influence of a, you know, all of a sudden you've got a big studio and it's like, well, here you've got $1.5 million for a special effects budget. And instead of like just existing within this sort of deadpan, real physical world, you know, you have Jack Black facing off against a bull and flying through the air. And of course, all of a sudden the entire world crumbles in front of your
it's
very
true.
Eyes. And these really strange sound effects, like the scenes in the preview of, you know, Jack Black and his beloved nun, you know, are nibbling on toast. And we have this like really overbearing sound effect of munching toast. And uh-huh. it's just like, this is sort of like the unfortunate kind of things where it's disrupting something he's put a great deal of energy into creating, and unfortunately I don't whether he's responsible or not, it's disruptive.
No, that's a great point. That scene, it didn't work in the trailer, it doesn't work in the movie where the bull spears him with his horns or whatever, because right. it looks so totally fake and right. it doesn't fit with the world he's created. And in fact, that entire montage of their training sequence really isn't funny
it's
at all. There's
funny.
A scene where he grabs a huge pile of poop on the ground and just rubs it in his partner Escalito, rubs it in his face
right.
for really no reason at all.
And in the Hess world, you know, his
funny.
Partner takes it with this deadpan, mm-hmm. you know, quality, you know,
right.
and it doesn't work. And I think just to give you an example of what we're talking about here, as far as what isn't entirely working for me, is this scene between Jack Black as Nacho and Ana de la Reguera as Sister Encarnacion.
Ignacio, I've been looking for you. Where have you been?
I've been here. I've been sleeping.
In a frilly shirt and slacks?
They are my peaches.
Can I come in?
No. People might get the wrong idea about you. Like maybe you are a floozy.
And I think what you have here is the equivalent of baby talk as comedy in some way, where you have these lines where he's referring to his PJs and her as a floozy, you know, as these, and it works as a sort of isolated, amusing scene, But over the course of an hour and a half, these, you know, we get frustrated with the fact that these people are supposed to have a relationship and all they do are making jokes. Or really, Jack Black is just making jokes.
Yeah, he is. You're right. And it seems odd maybe to some people even listening to this thinking, why are they taking this movie Nacho Libre so seriously? But I have to say that one of the big reasons why this movie doesn't work is because of the total lack of a story. And it could have been so much better. Even in a movie like Nacho Libre, you have to have some sense of a story and a conflict. And unfortunately, there's this great setup here where you've got a character who wants to be a real holy man. He's working in a monastery, and he has this conflict where the church, Encarnacion and the other brothers in the church, supposedly look down on wrestling. It's not holy enough. He shouldn't be doing it. That's a real interesting conflict if he was really someone who was conflicted by it. I mean, think of the comedic possibilities of a character who really truly is striving to be holy and devout and pure, but can't fight this urge of being a wrestler and kind of the sin of that. That could be really funny. That conflict is never there. It really is just a setup. It's there as a device. We're supposed to just buy it because Hess, I think, finds the world of the Mexican monastery funny, and we're supposed to just buy it rather than actually making it funny. It doesn't work.
Yeah, he really resists any sense of sincerity at all, or coherent storyline, yes, but I mean, and what Anderson uses this too, he uses like, you know, 70s folk and rock music to sort of create this bed of sincerity in some way in this deadpan universe. And Hess tries to do that too. And, you know, in this case, it's not like Cat Stevens and The Who, it's like Beck doing his, you know, 70s influenced kind of folk rock, and it's great, the music's great, but it doesn't quite work because he's not investing his characters in any kind of emotional reality.
No, you're right. But before we close out this discussion, Sam, maybe we should mention Jack Black. You've been hard on him on this show and said that really since High Fidelity,
Diminishing
he really
returns.
Hasn't given you much. What did you think about him here in this role?
I mean, again, it's just like he's asked frequently. The camera is just put on him and he's told to be funny when the script itself isn't very funny. And I think for that reason alone, it's just like I'm reminded of what works. But the thing that works best are the scenes where it's like he's doing his Jack Black from Tenacious D riffing.
You're right.
And those are some of the, and you're reminded of what he does so well. Unfortunately, this isn't the kind of thing that's really gives him that chance all that often.
No, Hess has him maybe too subdued and too deadpan for Jack Black to really work. And I agree with you that there were a few moments where I felt like, despite the deliberation Hess clearly takes with his humor, there were a few moments where it felt like nothing's working. So we kind of just had the camera on Black and said, do your thing.
Do your thing.
And unfortunately,
squeeze your buttocks, contort your face.
Throughout the course of an entire movie, an hour and a half,
it
doesn't work.
No,
okay.
Doesn't.
Well, if you've seen Nacho Libre and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. We may not get a chance to respond, but we will definitely read your email.
After the break, why do they call it PMS? We try to avoid answering that question next in our review of A Prairie Home Companion. Plus, stick around for your chance to win a free DVD in Massacre Theater and our countdown of the top five movies of the year so far.
Just an old cowboy with twigs in my hair, 2/3 alligator and 3/4 quarters bear and one half a lion. But let it be known, I never told one lie that was not my own. Whoopie tie, I-O, get along, little doggie.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Sam Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for tuning in to our debut show here on Chicago Public Radio. You can listen to Film Spotting right here on 91.5 WBEZ the last Saturday of every month. Or if you just can't wait another month for the next show, you can subscribe and listen to our weekly podcast by going to filmspotting.net.
That's right. And last week on the Film Spotting podcast, we reviewed Robert Altman's big screen adaptation of Garrison Keillor's popular radio program, A Prairie Home Companion. Coming out of the break, you heard Woody Harrelson and John C. Reilly as Prairie Home regulars, Dusty and Lefty, singing Whoopie Tie-Yi-Yo. Harrison and Reilly, we agreed, just one of the many pleasures of Altman's film.
It's true. We both really like this movie a lot, despite, it's fair to say, not exactly being citizens of Lake Wobegon.
That's right.
I've never heard Garrison Keillor's or Prairie Home Companion. I'm certainly familiar with it, but I mean, I've never actually listened to it. Not even a bit. I've never heard Garrison Keillor's voice until I watched
this film.
And I really am not probably any more inclined to start listening to the show on a regular basis, but I really did enjoy just about every moment of this movie. First of all, I think it's a perfect Robert Altman vehicle, obviously. You've got the multiple narrative threads converging in this one space, on stage, off stage, upstairs, downstairs, just like Gosford Park's upstairs, downstairs dichotomy. I think really this film perfectly lends itself to his signature overlapping dialogue, maybe even better than in Gosford Park, because those people were supposed to be characters and at least somewhat believable. And here, these people are storytellers. It feels more natural. It feels more organic to have the overlapping dialogue. But what I really enjoyed the most, Sam, and it hit me near the end of the film, and then it really crystallized for me actually during the end credits, was watching these people, these performers, perform. Mm-hmm. I really got to the point where at the end of the film, watching Woody Harrelson and John C. Reilly do this song called Bad Jokes, and the jokes are bad, but that's the idea. That's why it's called Bad Jokes, but they deliver it with such conviction, and they're having so much fun. And believe it or not, I actually thought of the movie United 93 at the end of this film, because I was thinking about how Greengrass in that film, as we talked about, chose to cast no stars at all, completely unrecognizable names for the most part, and I think he had a very good reason to do it. No individuals, nobody that you can really identify with if you recognized a face. Here, I think that if Altman had cast just people from the Prairie Home series that I'm not familiar with, I would have had a good time, but I don't think I would have had nearly the good time I had watching Meryl Streep eat up every moment of getting to be the character that she was and getting to sing and getting to see John C. Reilly, as I mentioned, and Woody Harrelson. I really did enjoy this movie, maybe a little bit to my surprise, despite the fact that I like Altman.
No, I completely agree. I had a great time myself. And I know Altman's thing is once he's cast a film, he's 90% done. That's his sort of theory, his sort of maxim. And you have to admit, you have to, when you watch this film, you have to think, I don't know if Kevin Klein had more than two or three lines, really. And really it's like, the business is up to you, Kevin Klein. And I liked Kevin Klein a lot, and I liked a lot of the performances in this. And I think I wasn't sure what to expect either. And I know what Garrison Keillor, in what he wants, I think he imagines, I read about this, he imagines a Wobegon, a Lake Wobegon movie, where we actually go to Lake Wobegon and we see these characters. And so I wasn't sure what quite to expect, because knowing going into this takes place at the Fitzgerald Theater, we weren't going to necessarily see Lake Wobegon characters, but in fact we do. It's really nice to see that there isn't really we don't see actors portraying these characters. They are the characters, and you keep expecting them to wink a little too much, or at least to be acknowledging the fact that they're playing characters. But it's like I was constantly surprised by the warmth and the and just how much sincerity and how much love they have and affection they have for these characters, and how much Keillor has for the characters. And I think you're right. I mean, you bring up this big difference between this and other sort of landmark Altman films, and it's the ambition of it. And this film isn't ambitious, and I don't think that's a flaw of it. It's just exactly what it is. If this film were to have the weight of ambition on it, I think it would sort of crush the whole spirit of the Prairie Home Companion radio show. And yet what he does do is bring this sort of pall of death, really, over the death of the radio show and of characters, possibly in the character portrayed by Virginia Madsen, the Angel Asphodel. I think you do need that, and I agree. I don't think I'm all that inclined to really go and listen to the radio show, because otherwise it really is just sort of a light, fun, good time. You need a sort of finality. You need stakes that are raised, even in this sort of silly, fun atmosphere. You need there to be stakes involved mm-hmm. in these characters. And I think they solve the problem with that really, really well. You know, and if you were to just tell the story, or if Altman were just to tell the story of a regular taping of the show, it wouldn't be as interesting.
No.
That being said, the whole thing is enjoyable. You brought up John C. Reilly and Woody Harrelson, who just nail this shit. And originally, somebody was telling me he had Lyle Lovett and Tom Waits in mind
right.
to play those roles, but you can't imagine anyone better cast. These two guys who have perfectly embodied, you know, dim-wittedness time and time again, and they just brilliantly pull it off here. I mean, like you said, that bad joke song is just full of the kind of silly pleasure, and yet it's just a really good time.
Darling, how can I stay here without you? I have nothing to ease my poor heart.
Tying in with our review of A Prairie Home Companion, we did our top five ensemble movies, because really, Altman, you look at his body of work from Nashville to Shortcuts.
I mean, credited with really creating, in some sense, the ensemble drama.
Yeah, without a doubt. So we did our top five ensemble movies, and Sam, your top five, we need to mention here before we get into the mailbag. We got some great listener feedback on our top five, and your top five ensemble movies were Stagecoach, City of God, Vanya on 42nd Street, Magnolia, and number one, Dazed and Confused, just out on Criterion Collection on DVD. And the movies that just missed your cut, you had Wonder Boys, and then a couple movies that most people aren't really into, except for you,
me.
Full Frontal and The Imposters, Beautiful People, and then a Michael Winterbottom pairing of Wonderland and 24-Hour Party People, and finally Nashville. So if that sounded like seven films and the movies that just missed your cut,
that's not uncommon.
6 through 10,
yeah,
it's
exactly.
not uncommon. That's right. There were a lot of movies. Sometimes we like to do ties here on Film Spotting. So those were the ones that just missed your cut.
Yeah, your top five ensembles. You had Altman's Nashville on here, Do the Right Thing, Kurosawa's The Seven Samurai, and also the American remake, The Magnificent Seven, then Boogie Nights, and your number one top ensemble film, Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. Mm-hmm. You can tell maybe our age. We came of age during the Quentin Tarantino era.
Yeah.
They are favorite films of ours and the ones that just missed your cut. A couple of Woody Allen films, Hannah and Her Sisters and Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Big Chill, Diner, The Usual Suspects, and the film that you like, maybe that's not a favorite of many other people, Cradle Will Rock, Tim Robbins.
Yeah, film. A film I really do adore. And we got this great email here to start off with from Chris Frazier, who wrote this in before we even got to our top five. This was just based on the movies that missed our cut. He said, am I wrong or is Adam on track for a flawless top 10 list with his latest picks in the best ensemble movies category? He singles out Crimes and Misdemeanors, my inclusion of that. And then he says, any list in this category without The Big Chill should be disqualified. The range and talent of Diner's cast was able to make us forgive the fact that Steve Guttenberg was in it. I think The Usual Suspects speaks for itself. And finally, Cradle Will Rock is an ingenious pick that is perhaps the funniest movie ever to take on the Depression. So, Sam, I got this email, and even before that, I said to you, we were talking on the phone one night.
After you had to praise your own.
I did. I was praising,
potentially flawless.
Patting myself on the back saying, you know what, my top five is really good. Even the 6 through 10, I mean, you've got Diner on there and The Big Chill. Yeah. These are movies that need to be on this list. And then I've got a personal favorite in Cradle Will Rock. I was like, this is a really solid list. Like,
and
this is infallible.
And then we got this email, from Chris from the Studio Upstairs podcast, who writes in his subject line, top five ensembles and no sales. Writing, Sam and Adam, I listened carefully, knowing your love for Lone Star, and found myself empty-handed at the end of the top five ensembles. So I'll throw a couple titles at you here. Limbo, Men with Guns, Lone Star, Sunshine State, Matewan, Return of the Sea Caucus 7. The only reason John Sayles is not rolling over in his grave is because he's not dead. But this top five list may kill him. Adam, I don't think you want that on your head.
I don't.
Can you revise the top five?
I'd like to revise the top five because after reading that, I realized instantly that I made a huge mistake. I don't know how I overlook Sayles, though sometimes I do like to leave off filmmakers, as you do from time to time, that we bring up a lot on the show.
Right.
And I don't know if we've overdone Sayles, but we're both big fans of Sayles.
Yeah, we are.
And Lone Star has come up numerous times on top five lists.
Matewan was one. I don't know. I think Wonder Boys may have knocked it out of my 6 through 10 for some reason.
Which is kind of ridiculous since it's not even really an ensemble.
I know.
But that's a discussion for another time.
Right.
But from those titles, Chris, thank you so much for pointing out the error of my ways there. All those movies are really good. The only one I would single out as maybe I'm not a big fan of is Sunshine State.
Yeah.
And his most recent Silver City I also wasn't into. But those movies you mentioned there, I mean, Limbo and Lone Star and Matewan and Return of the Sea Caucus 7, which I believe was his first film, are all really great films. Yeah. And I have no excuse. They belong somewhere in the top five.
We can be corrected. It's true.
Yeah. This one from Andrew Sorcini in Glendale, California. I enjoyed your top five ensembles list, and admittedly, my list shares too many in common with yours to repeat here, but I did want to mention a couple of notable omissions. L.A. Confidential. Between Russell Crowe, Guy Pearce, Kevin Spacey, and Academy Award-winning Kim Basinger, there are too many firecracker performances here to ignore. And also, Trainspotting. While Mark Renton may be the film's protagonist, it's hard to imagine this movie without Spud, Sick Boy, Tommy, and of course, Francis Begbie. Really, guys, how could you forget your show's namesake?
Maybe I don't know if I have a response to that, but I don't know if Andrew's trying to get his name, his like quote on the new DVD release of L.A. Confidential, like too many firecracker performances to ignore here. I mean, that's just
that's really. I mean, Peter Travers is jealous because exactly. That's good stuff.
But it's true. It's a good point. I think L.A. Confidential is one of those films that's almost become invisible to me as I put together my top five list. I think it qualifies for so many things, and I've certainly put it on more than a couple. So. You know, it's just, again, another one of those films that falls through the cracks by being too obvious.
Yeah, I agree completely. It was on my list up until final cut. I love it. I feel like I mention it too much on the show, and I left it out. And I also do, obviously, like Trainspotting, too. So, great choices there, Andrew.
Right. This one from Super Duper Jenny, who writes, "You both disappointed me greatly. Not only were your top five subpar, but your 6 through 10 were as well. Way too many great films were left out. I love you guys, but here's my top five. She's got Wet Hot American Summer, can't get a better cast. Mallrats, you left out a Kevin Smith film. Sin City, new but an instant classic and an incredible cast. Love Actually, the ultimate ensemble film. And her number one, and maybe the one we should be most shamed about, The Breakfast Club. It breaks my heart that this wasn't included on either of your lists. This is the definition of the ensemble film. Still love you. Still love you, though, and great podcast as always.
Thank you very much.
Super Duper Jenny.
I don't have an excuse, again, for The Breakfast Club. Another film I, of course, adore, maybe left off because it seems too obvious, but one of my all-time favorite films, without a doubt. So I'm going to briefly mention another great one here we got from Kevin Cardoza in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. He had The Ice Storm, The Royal Tenenbaums, Last Night, a Canadian film that sounds really interesting that's about this ensemble cast, how they deal in a personal way with the last day before the end of the world. He's also got Shortcuts, the Altman film, certainly could have made our list. We put Nashville on there. And then lastly, Glengarry Glen Ross. How can you make an ensemble list without mentioning the work of David Mamet? I don't know the answer, but I do know that I adored watching Al Pacino and Jack Lemmon trying to convince Jonathan Pryce to make a purchase his wife doesn't want him to make. And that is, of course, the classic scene with Pacino and Jonathan Pryce. And Glengarry, he wrote that email before we got to our top five, and I think we announced that, of course, this was the Glengarry Glen Ross Memorial Ensembles list.
The honorary third prize is your fired list. I mean, no list really is complete. Ensemble list, certainly, without one of our very favorite films, Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yeah, it is. It would have been number one if we hadn't memorialized it. So
the deal is dead, Jimmy. The deal is dead.
If you've got feedback for us, send an email or a short MP3 clip to feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-CINNA. That's 206-203-2463. We'd love to hear from you.
When we come back, Russian Vampires and Tommy Lee Jones' rumination on crime and punishment. We'll discuss a couple of recent DVD releases next, and stick around for Massacre Theater and our top five movies of the year so far.
If I could be a little bit younger, if I could be a little bit older, if I could be a little bit friendlier, if I could be a little bit colder, then I would be a little bit better. Yeah, I would be a little bit better. But I'm a middle man, stuck in the middle, right between anything tangible. Just a middle man, looking for a little, something that'll make me more radical. Well, it's the only thing I've ever been that's been undeniable.
In an effort to honor the truest DVD fans out there, PureFlix has launched the Show Us Your DVDs contest. PureFlix is searching for the shrine that best symbolizes a passion for DVDs. Just provide a photograph of your collection and explain a little bit about it. The grand prize is a 400-disc mega DVD changer and a free lifetime membership to PureFlix.
You do not need to be a PureFlix member to enter. Learn more at blog.pureflix.com or in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net. Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Holgren. We'd like to take just a quick minute to thank the Bottle Rockets and Chicago's own Bloodshot Records for today's music.
Absolutely. New music from their album Zoysia.
Yeah.
Great new music. We really do appreciate that and hope you are enjoying it. And Sam, before we get into Massacre Theater, I wanted to just take a moment to point listeners to the current poll question on the filmspotting.net website. Go to filmspotting.net and vote. Make your voice heard. We're asking you, what is the best movie of the year so far? Of course, tying in with the top five, we're going to get into our countdown here a little bit later in the show. And basically, we went to RottenTomatoes.com, saw the movies that are the most highly rated movies that we've discussed on our podcast, and think could be common choices on some of our listeners' lists. And so with that in mind...
Yeah, before the crush of actually really good films that come out usually the second half of the year.
That's true. So what is the best movie of the year so far? The choices are...
The choices are Brick, Inside Man, Thank You for Smoking, United 93, V for Vendetta, or, of course, Other, as there have been other films released this year.
Yes, several others. So, again, we'd like to hear what your vote is. Go to filmspotting.net and pick your best movie of the year so far.
Yeah, it's really soft.
Get on.
Oh, no. I got to go help with dinner.
Did you hear that?
Hear what?
Exactly. Individually wrapped springs. Top quality. I could do aerobics over here and you wouldn't feel it.
I bet I wouldn't.
So, Zach, would you say you're open to new things?
All right, time now for Massacre Theater. Last week on the Film Spotting podcast, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard from director Doug Liman's Go with Jay Moore and great character actor William Fichtner, a tie-in with last week's top five ensemble movies. Adam, reach into that Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Steve Shapiro from San Jose, California. Congratulations, Steve. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Now, you guys got to look menacing. Can you be more menacing?
No, no, Miss Lamont. Round tones, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line.
Mommy, acting is reacting. Now, we'll play this nice and close, just like in the movies, okay? And... action.
It's time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and Sam, we picked a scene that is from a movie that not only ties in nicely with last week's top five ensemble movies.
That's
this
true.
Is a movie that came up quite a bit on listeners' top five lists. How could you have overlooked this film? So we'll say that, first of all, it's an ensemble movie without a doubt, and a movie that certainly ties in as well with our top five of the year so far.
We should just
go ahead and give a hint. The director of this film is also the director of a movie that is going to appear
on
one of our lists later in the show.
That's right. Pay very close attention.
That's right. This director has also made a film that one of us thinks is one of the best of the year so far.
As far as I can tell, we've actually given you the answer already.
We have. I think so. Okay. So you start this one, Sam.
Right.
I'm going to give you the action.
All right.
And action.
They're saying something. I think they're conspiring to conspire. You know, I can feel the live vibrating from their home.
I don't think she's in on it, man.
Come on, I have dreams about this. I have actual dreams about this, about busting the top people, the rich people,
white people. I know, but I don't think she's in on it, man.
And scene. Stellar acting.
Stellar, yeah, really it is. You were apparently...
There's an ensemble in this room.
Apparently you were doing your Nacho Libre impression. It's not a scene.
Another clue.
No, it's not a scene from Nacho Libre, despite Sam's acting performance there. If you know what film Sam and I just massacred, email us now at feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced next Tuesday on the Film Spotting podcast. To listen, just go to filmspotting.net.
It began over 1,000 years ago when a truce was struck between the protectors of light and the warriors of darkness. For centuries, that delicate balance has always been guarded by the underground forces of the Night Watch.
When director Timur Bekmambetov's sci-fi action vampire epic Night Watch was released in its native Russia in 2004, it made a ton of money. In fact, it's the largest grossing film in Russian history. Two sequels have already been planned. The second film in the series has already been released overseas. We reviewed Night Watch earlier this year during its limited release here in the States, where, despite a Matrix-inspired plot and visual style, the subtitled film was confined mainly to the art houses.
And as you could probably tell from the clip we played, Night Watch isn't exactly original.
Right.
Bekmambetov definitely wears his influences proudly. in this film. That doesn't mean, however, that the film isn't a lot of fun.
Maybe the best experience, best time I've had in a theater in over a year.
No kidding.
And I couldn't wait to have this conversation with you, because as we say every once in a while, we have no idea,
right?
You know, the experience we had until we sit in front of these mics. Until the very end of the film, I was thinking this as a possible, you know, 5-star film.
Wow.
Only because it was so satisfying.
Uh-huh.
Sadly, the end does blow it.
Mm-hmm.
Without being funny, this film isn't funny.
No.
In fact, it's quite gory, and but it doesn't ever take itself entirely seriously either. And I'm not sure. There's several moments, I think, throughout where you get really obvious homages to films that they love. And I think ultimately what this film for me and what won it over for me was that it takes itself seriously enough, but not too seriously. And it never disguises the fact that it is stealing from movies that it loves,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's not trying to improve on them. I think simply looking at the fact that you've got a film that bills itself as a battle between an army of light versus an army of darkness.
Uh-huh.
And there are others that have special powers. It's just like, you couldn't strip that down. You couldn't strip that story down that we've seen 1 million times to its essence any further. And I think they know it, and they're not trying to
yeah.
hide. And I love that about it. And it was just exciting to watch.
Yeah, I agree with you that one of the strengths of this film is that it doesn't take itself too seriously. And it easily could when you're dealing with these themes
oh, yeah.
like light versus dark. I mean, it's about good versus evil. And if it took itself too seriously, it would be a problem. But there are nice little subtle moments, little jabs of humor here and there. You're right, it's not a funny movie, but there are enough little moments that diffuse all the lofty philosophical questions that are going on that you realize that, you know, it doesn't want to take itself too seriously, and you can just have fun with it. And I did have fun with it, though not as much as you. And I think the reason why is simply that when I look at my list of positives and negatives about this film, I can list many more negatives than positives, actually. And it's a film that I think really easily could be nitpicked apart. Fact of the matter is that I was totally won over by not only the visual energy of this film and
yeah.
the style of it and the way it does pluck from so many influences and
yeah.
does just seem to be having so much fun.
Where are y'all from?
Cincinnati.
Oh, long way from home.
Buscando trabajo.
¿Qué clase de trabajo?
Soy vaquero.
What line of work bring you to Texas?
Border Patrol.
Get down! Everybody!
Photo ID, sir.
Also out on DVD this week, The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada, the feature film, directorial debut from actor Tommy Lee Jones. Sam, we discussed Jones's Peckinpah-inspired film back in February when it was released in theaters, and unlike A Prairie Home Companion and Night Watch, where we were largely in agreement, here we saw two completely different movies. Earlier, you told me you were going to kind of go that route in your setup about Jones as an actor and how it translates as a director, and I was thinking about the word that best describes Tommy Lee Jones. When I think of Tommy Lee Jones as an actor, what word comes to mind? And the first word that popped into my head was craggy. You know, rough, rugged. That same kind of thing we see in a guy like Duvall.
Sure.
But Tommy Lee Jones, with those lines in his face, as you especially see here, the wrinkles, just weathered by time and getting older. Craggy is really what I thought of. And that's what this film is. Mm. We watched 8 Westerns as part of our Western marathon. We recently saw, of course, and talked about Brokeback Mountain. And the way a lot of those films, Ford, to some extent, Sergio Leone, some of these directors that really glorified nature. And you see Ang Lee do it as well, certainly in those moments of respite they have at Brokeback Mountain, the way they glorify nature. You don't get that at all here in this film. This small Texas town, the vastness of the border region, it might as well be outer space. That's really what I felt like watching, because it's so lonely and quiet. It's just about desolation. It's backbreaking. You're not seeing any lush trees, you know, mountains and flowing streams. There's rocks and caverns and just this sense throughout the entire film that there are things out there that will hurt you. Mm. And we see that happen to these characters. And there really were a number of things about this film, Sam, that really blew me away. The first half of it, anyway. And I'm sure we'll get into this, you know, as we go on.
There's a definite spot there, yeah.
There is. And early on, though, the authenticity of this film, I think that's something you could say Tommy Lee Jones brings to all of his films as an actor. And here you've got it as an actor and as a director. You can really just smell the smoke in this film, in these coffee shops that we see constantly depicted. Some of the characters go to this place very regularly. The coffee smell, the desperation in these characters, it's pungent. I really felt that as I was watching the film. And I also didn't think there was really any kind of judgment ever being passed on these characters, that the way he is setting this life up for these characters, I never got the sense that Tommy Lee Jones was trying to say that this is a good life or a bad life. It just is, which is something I found fascinating. And it made me think of the film we reviewed last week, Bubble, where, you know, it felt a little bit clinical. It felt like an experiment. Maybe even, as I suggested, maybe felt a little bit patronizing in that it's this outsider taking this distanced view of everything. And here you have Jones's presence in the film. You have Arriaga, who knows this place, obviously, and knows these people. And it just grounds it and makes it real the entire time.
Yeah, it's funny you bring up Bubble, because I thought of the exact same thing. And I found it, strangely, completely inauthentic. As much as I'm sure that Tommy Lee Jones knows this. I'm not saying that Tommy Lee Jones doesn't know this part of the country. He's from Texas. I'm sure he's very familiar, as is Arriaga, the screenwriter. But, Adam, I wanted to say, really, the word that came to mind for many of the characters, the depiction of these characters, was contempt, actually.
Wow.
I mean, particularly the Barry Pepper character, this kid from Cincinnati who comes down with his new wife and, you know, as a border patrolman. And he is just a nasty, vicious character from the outset. Mm-hmm. I found too many characters fell into this black and white camp. I just didn't feel like Tommy Lee Jones had a really good handle on tone here. So instead of, you know, there was no real gray area for me. So these characters fell into these camps of black and white. And I felt like Barry Pepper's character was just so awful depicted. I mean, just, you're shaking your head.
I'm absolutely shaking my head.
I was really surprised to find that. Again, you have like Melquiades, the character, an angel, Jones' character himself, I didn't think had any real subtlety to him. Maybe he was quirky, certainly, and his quirks and eccentricities reveal themselves to a greater degree as the film goes on, as we maybe realize that he's completely insane.
When we come back, it's the end of June, a perfect time to take a look back at the half year in film. We'll reveal our top five movies of the year so far next.
Now listen up, baby, let's get something straight. Things were getting old, things weren't that great. Hey. We had some times, really ripped it up. Know what you want to say, so let me interrupt. When I drank, and when I quit, and it's not my problem if you can't handle it.
Can you handle it? Can you handle it? Can you handle it? Can you handle it?
Now listen up, buddy, I don't need that drink. I don't care what you say, I don't care what you think.
No.
Talk around town that the old me's dead. You got that right, remember what I said.
Hello again, podcast listener. Time to announce this week's PeerFlix DVD winner of The Princess Bride, Dread Pirate Edition, just out on DVD last week. And the winner is Dave Strike from Mount Kisco, New York. Congratulations, Dave. Look for your copy of The Princess Bride in the mail soon, courtesy of PeerFlix.
Sign up for a PeerFlix account between now and Monday, June 26th, and you'll be entered to win Night Watch, out now on DVD. Go to peerflix.com/filmspotting or filmspotting.net and start trading the DVDs you have for the ones you really want.
Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Sam Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and it is now time to count down our top five movies of the year so far.
Right.
And Sam, this is something we did on our podcast last year for 2005. Halfway through the year, we thought, why not take a look back, see where we're at? Have we had any decent films? And I went back and looked at our list, and it turns out that while some of the films on each of our top five lists ended up being in our top 10 of the year, when we did our end of the year kind of extravaganza, only one film, Hustle and Flow, which I believe was, for both of us, our number one film.
That's true.
At that point, that was the only film that still was in our top five at the end of the year. And it's true as well that if you look at the movies that were on our most anticipated list of 2006, this is something we did earlier in the year on our podcast. We said, which movies are we most looking forward to? You had Talladega Nights, A Scanner Darkly, The Fountain, The Departed, and Babel. I had All the King's Men, Zodiac, A Scanner Darkly, Superman Returns, and The Departed. So we had some overlap there with The Departed and A Scanner Darkly. And the key thing here is that all eight of those films I just read haven't come out yet.
That's right.
So what I'm curious about is, are any of the films that are currently on your top five that we're going to get into, do you think they'll still be around at the end of the year on your top five?
Well, too, I want to point out, too, I mean, yes, the fact is the only one of the films that, you know, was in our top five last year appeared, you know, at the end of the year on a top list. But Crash, for example, which won Best Picture Oscar, was released actually relatively early, actually at the beginning of the summer
last year.
So it can happen. Some films do linger. And last year, I want to point out, too, that I think a lot of the big budget films were really disappointing. The Batman Begins, for me personally, Star Wars, War of the Worlds, and it was the smaller films that were helping redeem the year, like Miranda July's Me and You and Everyone We Know, Gus Van Sant's Last Days. And this year it's strange. The smaller films, there are smaller films that are kind of disappointing me, some we disagreed on, but films like Thank You for Smoking, Three Burials, Tommy Lee Jones' film we just discussed, played an excerpt from our review. And it's the bigger films, actually, that are surprising me and, you know, giving me the most sort of fun and surprise. Movies that, including films that didn't make my list, like Spike Lee's Inside Man, American Dreams, and most recently, The Breakup. And so I don't know what makes me feel more optimistic about the movie season, the fact that the big blockbuster films are good, even if some of the independent films are disappointing me. That being said.
My desert island, all time, top five most memorable breakups.
Top five musical crimes perpetrated by Stevie Wonder in the 80s and 90s go. Sub-question, is it in fact unfair to criticize a formerly great artist for his latter-day sins? Is it better to burn out than to fade away?
Top five side ones, track ones.
My number five, we already discussed it actually in an excerpted review. It is Night Watch. It's a film that, you know, huge in Europe. Got mixed reviews when it came here to the States, and the trailers, you know, showed off its derivative glory in some way. It's a Matrix-inspired film. But it has this bleak kind of wit that I loved, and it wears its influences so openly on its sleeve that it really, I felt like it had a sense of humor about itself. And yet it was still very, very effective. It had a real great, you know, visceral energy, too. It was truly terrifying in moments, and it was really one of the best times I've had at the theater this year.
Mm-hmm. Night Watch, a film I did like as well, obviously, as we heard, not as much as you. And this is a case for me with my number five, where we split a little bit on it. And my main criterion putting together this list was simply, which movies am I most looking forward to seeing again? That's the question I even ask myself when we do our end of the year.
Absolutely.
You know, when I'm making my top 10, which movies am I just dying to see again? And this number five, there's always an exception. And for me, it's this number five. It's United 93, a film I can't say I'm dying to see again here at any point. I know I will watch it at some point, but I'm not in a hurry to, because it is such an emotional experience to watch this movie. But I highly recommend the film, because I think it's not only an important film, but I think it's such a well-made film. And I love Paul Greengrass. I think Bloody Sunday and The Bourne Supremacy are both great films, and similar in many ways actually to what you see in United 93 in terms of its style. But here he's really put us in the position, I think, of witnessing the acts of the first people to live and be forced to act in a post 9/11 world. I found that fascinating. And again, I think that watching his kind of evolution as a filmmaker as well, you see some of those same kind of stylistic techniques he uses in Bloody Sunday and Bourne Supremacy, but here he's taken it to another level and is really effective.
It's up to you how this goes.
Because you know what I'm going to do next? I'm going to find her, whoever she is. I'm going to find her, and I'm going to hurt her.
All right, there you heard one of my favorite actors in one of my favorite scenes of the movie. That's Philip Seymour Hoffman as Batty Owen Davian in writer-director J.J. Abrams' Mission Impossible 3. Mission Impossible movies, the previous two, completely incoherent and forgettable experiences for me, so I couldn't have had less enthusiasm for this movie going into it. That being said, one of the most satisfying times I've had with a genre movie of this type in years. And with where so many of those kind of films lack wit and humanity, I think Abrams' Mission Impossible 3 has both of them. The action is exciting, and it doesn't necessarily subvert the genre, but it does absolutely fulfill genre expectations. And that is enough for me, and was enough of a surprise for me. And I really liked, I think he does a great job with the supporting performances, particularly one of my favorite performances of the year, as I said, Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah, he's great. And I think we both felt, unfortunately, that he was a little bit wasted, that Abrams should have given him.
But the rest of the movie was good enough that you don't miss him.
Yeah, that really was a surprise for both of us. I agree with you there.
My name is Dalton Russell. Pay strict attention to what I say, because I choose my words carefully and I never repeat myself. Recently, I planned and set in motion events to execute the perfect bank robbery.
And there you're hearing the narration from one of our favorite actors, Sam Clive Owen, from Inside Man. And you heard this narration in the trailer, which I think is worth just pointing out. I think maybe the Inside Man trailer was one of the most effective trailers I've seen in terms of sparking my interest, making me really interested in a film. Inside Man was great. It is my number four film of the year. You've got fantastic performances in this film by Owen and also Denzel Washington, who I know it's kind of easy to say he's good, but he is really good here and, of course, always brings some different shades to his performances. Basically, everyone in the film is really good except for Jodie Foster, who we ripped on pretty hard. But this film, a smart screenplay that I loved really because it knows that it's a bank heist movie. It knows that we've seen these bank heist movies a million times. And yet there was something new there. There was something about it that made it uniquely Spike Lee, I think. It's all about power. And as I said during our review, I think it's just fascinating to watch every scene, whether they're directly related to the bank heist or not. Every conversation in this film is a transaction of power, someone trying to gain leverage over someone else. It's what the whole film is about, and Lee handles it really well.
And he captures the feeling of those 70s films that really, whether they're working in a genre or not, he has a lot of fun with it and really lets the characters come to life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my number three film of the year so far is a film we discussed earlier in the show. It's Robert Altman's Prairie Home Companion. And it's a lot of these films. It'll be the last time you hear us or anybody else talk about the best film of the year in association with these films. And I think so it's nice to give them some props while they're still hot and out there. And I was just reading a Chicago Reader review of Prairie Home Companion that suggested that Altman's getting this free ride from critics with some overpraise of his recent more mediocre films. And I don't know, on the surface, I feel like Prairie Home Companion seems a perfect example of this phenomenon because it's such a light piece of entertainment. It's just so entertaining. I mean, there's lots of stage time for the all-star cast. It has this light, ironic tone that resists a kind of in-depth analysis in some way. But I think that's a lot harder to pull off than it looks. And the movie manages to be genuinely moving while retaining its playfulness. And it may not have the ambition of, you know, Altman's 70s masterpiece Nashville, but I don't think it's a crime to have fun. And the fun, I think, is contagious. I think we both agreed on that.
Yeah, I agree. Obviously, we did both like this film. And I don't agree with you, Sam, that you're necessarily going to get to the end of the year and find some of these films not appearing on critics' lists. I think you will find United 93, and I think you will also find maybe Inside Man occasionally popping up. But I think you really will find a few people who loved A Prairie Home Companion enough to include it. So we'll see if that happens. My number three is Sympathy for Lady Vengeance, or Lady Vengeance as it's known in the UK and as it was released here. This is a 2005 South Korean film by Park Chan-wook, just released in the States this past year, though. And it's the third part in his revenge trilogy, along with Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance and also Old Boy, which was one of our favorite films from last year. I think we had it both at number four on our list of the year's best films. I know I'm going to butcher the name here, so I apologize, but Lee Young-ai is amazing as Lee Gum-ja, a woman who seeks revenge on the man who is responsible for her spending 13 years in prison. He weaves together multiple narrations and cuts from time, the past, present, future, whatever. He cuts it all together with the narration, and yet you never really feel lost. It just really is effective at putting together this dreamlike quality. It's also more complex in its commentary, I think, on violence than a film like Old Boy, which half of the fun of Old Boy is just reveling in the main character being a badass. This is a little more nuanced than that.
So, where do you live?
I live with my mom right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's just a matter of money, really.
Oh. I'm
trying to save up. It's the easiest way to do it.
Yeah.
All right, what you just heard was Misty Wilkins as Rose and Dustin James Ashley as Kyle in a not particularly electric first date in director Steven Soderbergh's Bubble, which was released simultaneously in theaters, on DVD, and on HDTV. And one of the things that makes Soderbergh movies, I think, more interesting than all other movies, is his curiosity and sense of fun in terms of the projects that he chooses. And this film is the complete and total opposite of a movie like Ocean's 11 or Ocean's 12. It's got a cast of non-professional actors in this experimental, site-specific digital art project. And of course, that sounds completely alienating. But instead, I think it's really this fascinating portrait of a small town. I love the performances Soderbergh gets from this non-professional group of actors. And really, it's the pleasure for me of watching Soderbergh, this great film technician. He shoots his own films and he edits them as well. And really, for me, it's Soderbergh finding the power in the limited resources he has here. But the film totally worked for me. I mentioned it being a favorite film of mine the other night, and somebody said, oh, so you were the one that liked it. Mm-hmm. Meaning me of anyone in the world, not just of you. Although you liked it too.
No, I did like it too. A little less so than you. I saw it more as an interesting experiment into site-specific art, and I'm really fascinated by seeing what Soderbergh plans to do with this entire series of site-specific art. But definitely a good pick, an interesting film, something that's really worth checking out.
Has he told you where his brothers are?
With due respects, Mr. Fletcher,
Perhaps it would be wise to allow police work to be done by policemen.
Hmm.
That's David Wenham as the prissy Mr. Fletcher and Ray Winston as Captain Stanley in The Proposition, a really bleak Western from director John Hillcoat and written by the musician, the Australian musician, Nick Cave. We're reviewing it next week on our podcast, Sam, so I don't want to get into too much detail. It is definitely not a perfect film, certainly a flawed movie, but what I really loved about it was the unflinching way Hillcoat depicted the brutality of this landscape, how sentimentality free the movie is, and yet there really are some genuinely tender moments and some really complex characters. It should be a fun discussion. I'm looking forward to it.
So am I.
Listen, you're scratching at the wrong door. I didn't know Em well enough to know the details of what she was in. I just got wind of the downfall.
If you haven't got a finger in Em's troubles, then why did her name get me into your rather exclusive party?
Keep up with me now. I don't know, but it sounded like you did.
All right, that's Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Brendan and Nora Zahetner as Laura in writer-director Rian Johnson's film noir-inspired debut film. And really, put simply, this is the number one film of the year so far for me because it is the most exciting thing I've seen in the theater all year. It's got this rich, playful language, great stylized performances. It's beautifully and economically photographed, evocative original soundtrack, and it demands your attention and rewards it. And I think it's turned off a few people just because they're unprepared or unused to having to pay so much attention to a movie, particularly a movie that appears to be a sort of stylized high school movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really so much more than that. And Rian Johnson has just done a wonderful job.
Yes, he has. First-time filmmaker. I agree completely. No big surprise here. Brick is also my number one film of the year. And I actually want to play a clip as well from the film. Here it is.
Emily said four words I didn't know. Tell me if they catch.
Brick?
No.
Or bad brick?
Nope.
Tug?
Tug. Tug might be a drink. Like milk and vodka. Or something.
Poor Frisco?
Frisco. Frisco Farr was a sophomore last year. Real trash. Maybe had a class a week. Didn't know him then. Hadn't seen him around.
That's Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Brendan and Matthew O'Leary as the brain. And I think from that clip, you hear it there. I love the pacing of the hard-boiled dialogue, obviously derivative of these old film noir films, the way everything moves so fast that characters never stop to ask people exactly what they're saying, to clarify something, because they know they're going to run out of time, maybe. They just try to get as much information as possible and piece it all together later, which is kind of...
Yeah, there's again, a great momentum to the movie.
Yeah, going back to that old-school, hard-boiled detective kind of movie and kind of literature, I think it's great. Made for $500,000, which is really incredible when you see the film. Very Lynchian. I think if you're into David Lynch, especially if you're into Twin Peaks, you'll notice a lot of connections there, and I think you'll like it. And it's a film that I believe is still being kind of rolled out regionally in certain places, but it's come and gone from Chicago. I'm not sure how many screens it's still on, but it will be out on DVD August 8th.
And that is our top five. Please send your top five movies of the year so far or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message. We'll be back next month with another top five and more reviews of new movies right here on 91.5 Chicago Public Radio. In the meantime, you can go to filmspotting.net to listen to the weekly Film Spotting podcast.
Next week on our podcast, inspired by a recent Onion AV Club article, we'll reveal our top five character actors who should be in every movie. And Sam and I will retreat from the multiplex for a little art house roundup.
Do anything you want to do. You can be anybody you want to be. You just have to decide on it.
I better go. My dad's gonna kill me.
I was up the whole damn night worrying about you. I'm not done talking.
We'll have reviews of Down in the Valley with Ed Norton and Evan Rachel Wood, and also my number two film of the year so far, The Proposition. The week after that, Superman Returns. Hear our review plus our top five movie scores.
Check out our top five archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at filmspotting.net. Also, on the Film Spotting blog, you can sign up for The Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting weekly email blast.
This radio edition of Film Spotting is presented by Chicago Public Radio with editorial assistance from Christina Stevens and Joe Dassault. Our thanks to the Bottle Rockets and Bloodshot Records for today's music. More information about the Bottle Rockets is available at bloodshotrecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Hallgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Swap the DVDs you have for the ones you really want at peerflix.com/filmspotting. And also by Honda Fit. The all-new Honda Fit is small on the outside, yet roomy and versatile on the inside. A VTEC engine, anti-lock braking system, and front side and side curtain airbags are standard. And for added style, there's the Fit Sport Automatic with rear roofline spoiler and wheel-mounted paddle shifters. The Honda Fit is set and ready to go. Check it out at fit.honda.com.